The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew is proudly sponsored by Restaurant Owner App. Restaurant Owner App is a free app designed by a restaurateur for restaurateurs. Visit restaurantownerapp.com for more.
This is Michael Harlan Turkel, host of The Food Scene. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew, where we serve a weekly menu of industry commentary based on what the market has to offer. I'm Andrew Friedman from Tokeland.com.
I'm Jimmy Bradley from The Red Cat.
The second annual Harlem Eat Up Festival begins today. Actually, sort of began last night with a kickoff party. It is a four-day festival combining dinners, performances, and a convergence of food, art, and culture called The Stroll. The festival was founded last year by veteran event marketer Herb Carlitz and by our guest chef today, chef, restaurateur, and Harlemite, Marcus Samuelson. Welcome, Marcus.
Thank you for having me, guys. I'm so happy to be on the show with both of you. And congrats to the show. This is like big things. That's cool.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Marcus is, Marcus needs no introduction, but we'll introduce him. He is, of course, the force behind such restaurants as Street Bird Rotisserie, Red Rooster Harlem, Jenny's Supper Club. This fall, he's going to be opening a Red Rooster in London.
Yes, in a neighborhood that probably reminds me of Bushwick the most in London. In Shoreditch, it's probably the Bushwick of London, I would say, because of the creativity that's going on.
Interesting.
Yeah, very interesting community.
So we'll get into that. Marcus has written several books, most prominently probably his memoir, Yes, Chef. And is involved in restaurants all over the world, Bermuda, Sweden, Norway. Before we get into this, we're going to go a little Marc Maron, by which we mean we're going to be a little personal. We're so happy you're here. First of all, is this a mistake? How can you be here on the opening day of, you're in the wrong borough, Marcus.
The scheduling gods worked.
But Jimmy asked, and I was like, are you kidding me? Like, when my chef friends ask, it's like, you just got to get up an hour earlier. Yes, chef, it is.
I have goosebumps now. Yeah.
No.
Well, it's obviously, somebody like you on the show is what they would call a get, you're obviously a big name. Jimmy and I have known you for over 20 years.
Forever. You were one of the first people I met in New York when we started working. And, Andrew used to be our good friend Philip Bald's boss. And Philip and I kind of looked at each other like, Philip looked at me like, what are you doing? How do we do this stuff? And I'm like, I don't know. You're supposed to know. And I was like, I'm going to go and ask Andrew. He knows. He actually has no... I think, it was Andrew didn't have roommates, and that was the criteria of, if you made it. So
I still feel like today, I Andrew will know. Let me ask Andrew.
Well, now I have goosebumps. Yeah. But anyway, we're just so happy to see you. It's great. The social media and the, people will probably, our listenership will probably go up after having you. But we were just so excited to have a chance to see you today. And, Jimmy and I were trading stories before the show. I've got about five or six of these, but I'll never forget when I was working with you. And you just mentioned it. I don't talk about it much, but I did get around guys like you as a publicist.
Yeah.
And there's an event called Chef's Night Out that happens the night before the Beard Awards.
Never heard about that.
And I will never forget being at that event one year and you and I, our eyes kind of locked from across the room. You were talking to someone who was hosting a Food Network show at the time and you immediately excused yourself and came over.
Yeah.
And I said, Marcus, what are you doing? Maybe you should get on that show you can't come over to me now. And you said, Andrew, that show's going to get canceled one day, but you and I are going to still be friends.
Absolutely.
I'll never forget it.
That's a great story.
You know, the other cool stuff about the place that we're in, Roberta's, right? Roberta's really inspired me about Rooster in the sense of that Bushwick, you see Bushwick when you're here, you see the community. If you don't know about Bushwick, you can come here and you see a part of the community.
Right.
And there's really a couple of restaurants that really inspired me about Rooster. And Odeon has always been that way of seeing the community in Tribeca. And Jim and I, we talked about this before, but when Red Cat opened to me, I've never seen a restaurant like that. Like, as a chef, there's a writer over there, there's a lawyer over there, there's a singer on table 51. The food is just yummy and delicious. It's a bar, but not necessarily a bar scene.
Right.
You walk in and it's like, it's packed, you know.
Yeah, so, it's very adult and it's very democratic.
But also very different time. When remember that when Jim opened on 10th or 11th, 10th Avenue, right?
Yeah.
So those Odeon, Roberta's, and Red Cat has always sort of been in my head what, in my own way, how I want Rooster to be.
Yeah.
And obviously a lot of Harlem in there, of course.
But yeah,
those are constantly the restaurants. And it's, as you guys know, the food scenes have changed so much.
Yeah.
But I just remember the other day, like I said, probably 6 months ago now, I walked into Red Cat, got the door slammed in my face, raining outside, no seat.
Oh, geez.
And I'm just like, check, they're doing it. I love it. I was super happy. I said to my, we're not going to get a seat. Doesn't matter. I just wanted that same, you know, that energy that you get?
Yeah.
I'm like, still crushing
it. I'm happy and my heart is breaking.
No, it's the good stuff. It's the good, but we talked, you know, I told you before, but it's like a lot of chefs think about Red Cats at that. We want to create a Red Cat. Well, you just can't.
Yeah.
You can't.
Yeah.
Well, you can, but your aim needs to be true. And we can talk about that in a minute. For me, one of my favorite Marcus moments is, you know, before I met you, I think I was talking to Phil Baltz about you and maybe even Andrew. And one of the stories they were telling me was that you put sand. You used to have sand on your kitchen floor and you cook barefoot. Oh,
yeah,
and I was like, okay, holy fuck. That's a cool cat. And I got to meet that cat. I think we started talking and socializing a little, and then it kind of came, you know, we would see each other in Aspen and the food events and so on. And then when you called me about the Red Cat, or the Red Rooster, I should say, and we spoke about the Red Cat and so on, and I was like, that was kind of the full circle moment for me, where I was like, you know, I mean, you pick and choose who you like and who you respect and so on. And I at both, you know, I held both positions. You know, I thought you were a cool cat, and that sand story is one of my favorites.
Well, can we just explain, because we're doing this in a little shorthand. You used to live in what neighborhood would we call kind of the north part of Hell's Kitchen?
Yeah, absolutely.
And you had a one-bedroom apartment, and you had a typical New York apartment. I wrote about this once on Tokeland.
You could see
and on the floor,
there was sand.
You had completely covered your floor in sand, and you would go in there barefoot.
Yeah.
And the reason for that was what?
No, it's just, it was so stale. My whole environment was stale. I just wanted a vibe that I felt like closer to the beach. And, you know, it's also, it was like, I was single at the time. It's like a cool chick thing. It's like, you know, the whole vibe was just like, my apartment was so dull. I felt Midtown was so dull. So I'm like, at 9F, it was always a party.
Yeah.
See, that to me is the example of that's how come you can do the Red Rooster, and that's, you know, what you said, maybe other people can't do a Red Cat type concept. You know, if you have a thought and your thought is true and your thought is about, you know, fulfilling yourself, but also giving lots of people lots of things to hold on to.
Yeah.
You know, your aim is true. You can get it done. You know, a neighborhood joint has to do certain things that other restaurants don't do. You know, it can't be a destination spot.
No.
You got to leave lots of room for walk-ins. Unfortunately, not enough the last time you were there.
Yes.
But, you know, the dynamic's always changing, you know, like you alluded to as well. But the core part of that, which, you know, you and I spoke about at length, is this, you know, like in diplomacy, they call it, you know, walking soft and carrying a big stick. You just, you have to have a really good sense of who you are and what you want to accomplish.
Yeah.
And listen, if you're the guy who's going to put sand down on the floor to create a feeling, you're the guy who's going to pull off a Red Rooster, no problem.
I do remember going to the board, the co-op board, and they're like, a restaurateur, there will be a lot of parties. And I was like, And I'm like, you know what? I invited everyone on my floor to the parties, and then they just like, you know what, if you keep inviting us, because they met chefs, they met all these cool people, you know, like a bunch of Swedopians and shit like that, and they're like, if you keep inviting us, we're not going to call you out. I kept inviting
them. You got to grease the wheels.
Yeah.
So we want to get to the Harlem.
Yes.
But can we get to this through your story?
Yes.
Now, obviously, some of this is in your memoir, but can you just talk a little about you first come to New York City in the early 90s, and end up at Aquavit, and end up in pretty short order becoming the chef at Aquavit.
I came post Vanilla Ice.
to set the time.
Yes.
Okay,
yeah,
that's a good reference. Yeah. you know, when you first came to New York, did you imagine that you would, that you were about to become a permanent New Yorker, that this was going to become your home when you first came to the city?
It's, you know, I came to the city with $300 and a big thought.
Yeah.
You know? And I just wanted to get in. I wanted in. That's it. You know, I wanted to cook. I came from France at a 3-star Michelin restaurant where my boss at the time said, you cannot own a restaurant in this country. No one's going to come to your restaurant.
Yep.
And I, you know, you can take that two ways. Either he was really cruel or he was really honest.
Right.
And I always looked at it like, you know what? He really tried to be honest with me.
He wanted to save you the pain of learning that yourself.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he said, you should go to America. And then it was really my dad that said, you know, let's go to New York. Because if they, and he said, like, if they have a black mayor, they will one day be open to someone that has ambition, happens to be black, and they come to your restaurant. Like, that was my dad's thought. So, like, you know, I went, and a lot of so many things, as you, you guys know, happens to all of us when we come to New York. Part of it's by design.
Right.
Part of it is so random.
Yep.
And Bobby and I cooked last night, and we looked at each other like, you know, Bobby and I, we had a friend that passed away. You know, that was a really good chef. He was my chef. I become the executive chef because this guy passes away.
At Aquavit.
At Aquavit. Yep. I mean, how random, weird is that? And Bobby and I, we just, you know, we always have a drink and we talk about that guy. And it's 20 years ago. We still, of course we're over it, but we never really over it. You know what I mean? And that's set then up me to be very successful. This horrible, horrible incident. You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, you don't design that.
Yep.
But then the other part is you get an opportunity and you go for it. And we've all had those moments, right?
Sure. Yeah. And you were 23.
Yeah.
Got 3 stars in the New York Times, which was youngest person to do that.
Yeah.
And then talk for a minute about sort of your gradual sort of immersion and relocation and identification with Harlem, how this became such a huge part of your life, and then this leads us to what's going on right now.
Well, I do think, obviously, the blessings of being a black man have things to do with it. You know, like, I identify with Harlem because of its culture and history. It doesn't mean other people don't.
Yep.
But I do that, of course, because part of it is because of the heritage of African-American culture, which is such a beacon outside America that it's almost hard for Americans to understand how big the idea of Harlem is, right? Because anywhere you go in the world, people of color, they look at Harlem as that's where James Baldwin, that's where the Apollo, that's where Romare Beard and all of this culture stuff happens. So the fact that you can then have a restaurant in that village that then sort of is part of representing that community, it's a really, really big idea, larger than the four walls of the restaurant.
Sure.
So, you know, I just didn't think that I knew Harlem well enough. So it took me 10 years. I lived there for 8 years before I opened the restaurant.
Yeah.
And it really happened because of after 9/11, you know, like where I felt like, you know, should I go back to Sweden? Because I really felt emptied out after that. I was like, you know, what am I doing? I'm just cooking in Midtown and being really busy, but...
So you don't mean 9/11 affected you in a sense of security. You meant more it was a moment to sort of evaluate your life.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
I cooked at the Tower a week before that event. Michael and I was cooking. We were laughing.
Michael and Monica.
Yeah, we're cooking for CCAP, for Careers for Culinary Arts. Young kids, all of that stuff that you guys know about. A week before. And I know, I mean, like, I knew a lot of guys. We all knew guys there. And it's like, after that, I was like, what the hell am I doing? I gotta rethink.
There needs to be something more to this.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it took me a long time to figure sort of my soul and my purpose out.
Yeah, I was stuck in the middle because I was just about to open the Harrison.
Yeah.
I just had to bear through that moment. But I had a lot of the same thoughts that you're saying you had as well.
And it's kind of awkward to talk about it because you don't want to...
You don't want to trivialize the tragedy.
Exactly.
Yeah, of course. But I think a lot of people identify with what you're talking about. It was a moment that really...
You don't know where the next opportunity is gonna make itself available for you.
Yeah. So, Marcus, talk a little about, you know, you, obviously, you're a chef restaurateur, you're a chef restaurateur author, but, you know, you're someone and, you know, you're not completely singular in this, but it is a little unusual. How do you think about your role these days and beyond the categories that I just named like a yeah. second ago? Do you? I mean, it seems to me that, you know, the chef, the role of a chef in society today, and I don't yeah. want to get too precious about it, but, you know, there are a lot of chefs who are involved. You know, it used to be that... you know, a chef being involved in some kind of civic way was having a tasting station at a benefit. Mm-hmm. That was about the extent of it.
Sure. 20,
like when you first came to New York, when Jimmy
big
started.
Deal.
That, but that was kind of what you did.
A now, taste of the nation. That yeah, was but, a
yeah.
big deal.
Yeah, and those things are great. I'm not putting those down.
Absolutely.
But you, you know, now chefs are so educated. They are, they're kind of schooled on topics in the way that real advocates are, you know, mm-hmm. they function in a way that used to sure. be almost unheard of, and whether it's environmentalism, sustainability, mm. You know, in your case, maybe, you know, focusing on certain neighborhoods. But what do yeah. you see? What do you see your evolving role as?
Well, I think it's a couple of things about that. I think that it go back for me, the word of restaurant, the word restaurant means, you know, essentially to restore your community. And being local means different things. Being local, for me, means hiring from the community.
Right.
We're fortunate enough to have 200 employees in that community. That changes the footprint of dining, but also changes the footprint of aspirations of the job. You don't have to leave your community to have an aspirational job in our our industry.
Yeah.
That's a role that's how I view green. That's how I view local. On top of that, I think about our local farmers markets as well. But I can kind of, if we restore the community through food and hospitality, the farmers market will sort of come out of that.
Mm-hmm.
The better school lunches that we work on at the same time with the chef will come out of that.
Right.
But we need a strong hospitality. And the reality is that inner cities in America has for a long time been neglected in these type of discussions. So if I'm a chef with a platform and have opportunities more than I can take care of, I should share. My duty is to share, and that's what I do together with our team. And, you know, Harlem Eat Up is the fruit of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not just about Rooster or Street Bird. We're now saying, hey, this is in a community that in a time where most people are overexposed, these small restaurants are underexposed. Go to Charles Pan Fried Chicken. Go to Lola Seafood. They're just as cool
right.
as things that are being portrayed in this very borough.
Right.
Come and see them. They're great people.
And they also have a history.
They have a history.
Yeah.
They diverse. They tell new stories, but it's rooted in the from the past. So my point is, like, yeah, it's great to know about Paris and all these other places, but also come and rediscover Harlem. It will be fun.
What is your? How do you think? You know, I actually went to Columbia University,
yes.
right, which is basically in Harlem.
Yeah.
I don't want to say when it was, but
yeah.
it was 85 to 89.
Yeah.
So you can do the math and figure out my age. But you know, I never had this. You know, like when I used to come back to school, you know, and come in at the airport, I would always make the shortest way to go was through Harlem.
Yeah.
And I used to have to insist that cab drivers would do that. They didn't want to go through,
yeah.
come down, you know, 125th Street and all that.
Yeah.
It was never an issue for me. It
yeah.
never bothered me. But Harlem, forever, it really is, you know, people I think in their 20s today, let's yeah. say, maybe can't even recognize the sort of mental barrier that
yeah.
used to exist to get people who didn't live in Harlem
yeah.
up to Harlem.
But it was also designed, right? We got to be honest about integration, segregation in many numerous ways, right? It was also by design. So in the community where I live on a very nice street
yeah.
in Harlem, there used to be four methadone center in my block
yeah.
and four jails.
Right.
Right?
Four jails?
Yeah, four
okay.
jails. Well, that creates then, now I can walk to work and there's a farmer's market instead on the weekend.
Yeah.
Now that's game changing.
Yes.
So one can't just say that people in Harlem that at that time lived there and it was bad things. These were by design put in those communities.
Right.
You can't just put a restaurant next to those four.
Correct.
Tents.
Yeah.
So these things that we think, oh, this community is bad, or I don't understand how the Bronx is not connected to the rest of the city. By design.
Right.
Right? So people would not be diverse together.
Yeah.
But when you look at Rooster, it presents something that is the opposite. It challenged that status quo.
Yes.
When you look at Harlem Meetup, where you have tons of things that you can come and see this weekend, 15,000 people will come up, eat, and they will be extremely diverse audience. So that challenge then, that's we're offering something that is opposite of where we came from.
Right.
With still highlighting the culture aspect. So the people are kind of like, I think things are just going to change. Things are not just going to change.
Yeah.
You have to work towards change.
Totally.
Hard.
Yeah.
And that's one thing that we know as cooks is that everything that happened, we have to work for. You know what I mean? So it's not a foreign thought to me to fix these things or work on those things.
You mean your orientation as a cook is that everything requires...
You work together.
Years of, right.
Yeah, you talk shit.
And collaboration.
And you talk, and you and you're
fine. You might have the seeds, but you got to figure out how to make it grow.
Yes.
You know, so you need the proper dirt.
Exactly.
You need the proper climate, and you need the proper water, and that could be attributed to staff or guests or purveyors. Mm-hmm. But it's really, you know, metaphorically speaking, pretty simple to see it, like planting some seeds and trying to get some life out of it.
We're talking with Chef Marcus Samuelson, co-founder of Harlem Eat Up Festival, which begins technically today.
Yeah.
And we're going to take a short break. And when we come back in just a minute, we're going to talk with Marcus about some of the highlights of this coming weekend. And we'll get into some other stuff around the festival. Maybe we'll also talk about his upcoming London restaurant when The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew returns.
Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew is proudly sponsored by Restaurant Owner App. Restaurant Owner App is a free app designed by a restaurateur for restaurateurs. Restaurant Owner App empowers you to organize your restaurant from the palm of your hand on any iPhone or Android device. Place orders, track orders, and customize supply lists to track the organization of your kitchen or storeroom. Accomplish electronically what you've been doing by hand for years. Restaurant Owner App also allows you to see orders placed by your employees, so you're always in the know. Create a personalized vendor database and review past orders at any time. It also features promotions and specials on goods and services for the hospitality trade. Visit restaurantownerapp.com for more information. Or to download for free and start organizing your restaurant today, search for Restaurant Owner App in the Apple App Store or in Google Play for Android phones.
Welcome back to The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew. We're talking today with Chef Marcus Samuelson. Marcus, tell us, so the Harlem Eat Up Festival begins, again, like I said, technically today. Can you just, I mean, in your own words, just can you kind of lay out the weekend? I mean, obviously not every event, but the broad strokes of the weekend.
Yeah.
And maybe a little bit about what you guys learned. Last year was just the first one.
Yeah.
It's a huge undertaking. What you learned and what maybe is different this year?
Well, I mean, Herb Carlitz has been amazing, and he has so much restaurant experience.
This is your co-founder of the event, who's a well-known for a couple of decades now. I guess we would call him an event marketer here in New York.
And, you know, Herb and I sat around. I was like, let's create a festival. You know, cities come alive through festivals. And I remember going to South Beach Food & Wine one of the first times, and I'm like, Lee, you're really putting a festival here? What are you talking about? You know, you think about Austin, you think about Southwest and so on, Tribeca Film. So we felt there was an opportunity to really do something special here. But we knew we needed all the restaurateurs in Harlem. So Melba Wilson's going to cook with, she has a guest chef. Then you have like Andy from Park Box going to cook at Mountain Bird, which is going to be like... Andy doing Thai food in a Japanese restaurant in Spanish Harlem.
Yeah.
I mean, that's Harlem Eat
Up.
You know,
that's great.
And then, so there's cool dinners like that. Justin from Upland is coming up. Alex Dupac is coming up.
Yep.
Alex Monticello is coming up. So all these guest chefs are working with the local Harlem chefs. That's an experience that is very important because, you know, it's also a big party for the local chefs to say, hey, we're hosting these world-class chefs. We can do it too. We're on the same level. Look at us. So it's that that work is sort of 3 months ongoing, planning the menu and all of that stuff.
Sure.
Then you have the stroll over the weekend where there's both things for free, cooking classes. Emerald's going to have his cooking class. So, bam, there you have it.
Yeah.
Aaron Sanchez is going to have a cooking class. So all
you have that cookie kid this year, right?
Yes, yes,
that's
yes.
That's the most adorable thing.
He trust me.
Who is this? Just for our listeners who don't know who the cookie kid is.
Mr. Corey is this 11-year-old food entrepreneur that he's just the cutest kid, and he has a cookie company and that him and his mom built together, and they're doing really well, you know, and it's like you're thinking about, you're talking to an adult, but he's 11 years old, so yesterday in the middle of dinner, he's like, I gotta go home, my mom sent me home. I'm like, but Corey, the main course hasn't gone out. Gotta go home.
Right.
And I'm like, you know, I can't mess with mom.
Yeah.
He's gonna run his own company one day.
Yes, absolutely.
So this takes, am I correct, this is in Morningside Park?
Morningside Park.
Yeah.
And the festival has some ticketed events. You can go and get tickets. There's all the Harlem restaurants will be there. We set up a 6-foot table. You can taste all the restaurants. And then there will be tons of stuff for the family, cooking classes for free, tons of kids activation. And just like you know, you want to meet Melba, you want to meet Trinesse from Sylvia family, you want to meet Emerald, this is your chance to do it. If you're a foodie, you should really be there.
What do you hear from people? I assume there's a lot of people who come up to this event who have literally probably never come up to Harlem, ever. Maybe even people who've lived in New York their whole life.
And that's
What do you hear from these people?
First of all, thank you for putting this together. And then once the festival is done, I'm like, don't go back down or up. Walk around, like Melba's restaurant is right around the corner, or the beer garden is across the street. Hang out. You want to create a level of normalcy that it's just like you would do in any other neighborhood in New York, right?
Yeah.
And meet different people. And there will be DJs. There will be tons of food activation. And for you just to stroll, truly stroll in the neighborhood and meet some friends or meet some new friends.
Yeah. There's, you know, historic. It's always interesting when chefs get together, you know, you know, years ago, it was a novel thing from chefs from different cities in the United States to get together, right? And then it's really ironic that you can have some of the chefs who have been established in Harlem for a long time. The novelty now, I think, and I don't mean novelty in a negative way. I just mean it is a new thing in a lot of ways. These pairings that you were just describing, that is probably as radical a notion as any sort of coming together, ironically, because a lot of these people operate, you know, 2 miles from each other.
Exactly.
Right?
But exactly.
What's that give and take like between, you know, you mentioned somebody like Andy from Pock Pock or someone like Justin or somebody like Alex, and then they get together with these people who have these deep roots in up in Harlem doing their food. What kind of exchange happens when these people connect like that?
That's such a good, I mean, Harlem Eat Up is really all year around. But the activation is really the 3-4 days.
Mm-hmm.
But throughout the year, we meet. And it's really also coaching these small businesses. How can they put in a better system? How can they market themselves in a different way? How can they take reservation or not take a reservation the way Jim was talking about, right?
Right.
And it's also a vehicle for them to trade ideas, get together, plan, saying, no, I want this chef in my restaurant. Well, he did really well with us last year. This guy. So it's also the restaurant hospitality community get together. And then, of course, you know, to have someone like Alex Stupak or like to have Alex Conicello or Justin, whoever you want of these sort of big name chefs. But it goes both ways. When you meet Charles from Charles Pran Fried Chicken, it changes everything. You're never going to fry a chicken the same. You're never going to fry that bird the same again, right?
Right.
So being, as we know, as being famous or being good are obviously two separate things. And at Eat Up,
this is true.
They meet in a very dynamic way. And after Eat Up, the chefs from downtown very often come back up, not just to Rooster. They go deep in Harlem and like, hey, I was just hanging out with Chef from Mountain Bird. That tasting menu was amazing. And I said, thank you for doing that.
How about that tasting menu in Harlem?
Yes.
Fantastic.
They get the bug. They want to like explore. And it's like I said, it's this whole community that's right, like a subway right away.
Yeah.
But also it's, you know, when you're describing Eat Up, it's like you're describing the birth of Rooster as well, too. You know, they're not mutually exclusive. You know?
They're not.
They're somewhat tied together.
But we've been lucky in our hospitality industry. A lot of things have changed. But a couple of things have not changed. People want to have a good time. They want to have it around great food, great hospitality, and great drinks. And how we now talk about that or upload that may have changed.
Yeah.
But, and people want to be around interesting people, right? So whether that's a festival, a big restaurant, a small restaurant, famous, all of that is almost like, it's almost secondary. But we want to discover neighborhoods through food.
Right.
And Bushwick is doing that through not just Roberta, but through many restaurants, of course, the way I felt Marlowe and Sons did that in that part of Brooklyn before. So I think the Bronx is going to be next. I think, you know, Queens has always been a discovery through food and restaurants. So that's sure. not even next. That's like, it's there, you know. So, no, I definitely think it's not going to be a place in this city where you're not going to see great food. It's just not going to happen.
Right. In people's minds, they might lump New York together as one big city, you know, which it is, 8 million people. But 8 million people live in 50, 60, 70, 90 different neighborhoods. Yeah. That some, you know, I mean, there's probably 15 neighborhoods, maybe more, just in Manhattan alone.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are people that do lump it together, but then there's operators like yourself who really celebrate the difference that three blocks can make, you know?
And there's also the challenge that the city has given us. It is tougher to run a restaurant today. It is more expensive.
Oh, wow.
So
yes.
We all know this stuff. So it's like, all right, let's go. Let's go to other places within the city.
Right.
And then let's start. You know, maybe it's a smaller restaurant, but the food is really banging, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, the beauty, there's tons of beauty in that. And, you know, to me, the only really negative side is, but it's a little bit like this with everything. The loyalty is a little askew.
Yeah.
You know, we used to see people four nights a week, and now we might see them two nights a week, which, hey, listen, not complaining.
Well, that's still better than, like, a lot of people.
But
we're
not a destination restaurant. Yeah. We're like that, you know? And maybe it's not four nights a week. Maybe it's a lunch or two and then a couple dinners or a brunch, you know? Maybe it's one with business and one with your girlfriend and one with your buddies, you know, with Roosters like that, Red Cats like that. It's built, you know, people, when we opened, and I'm sure this happened for you, you know, I was just labeled comfort food.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't even know what comfort food means. If people really just wanted comfort food, every Irish diner in America or Irish pub would be full. My thought is people want to be made to feel comfortable and they want to know you care.
Yeah.
And if you do those two things as well as execute on a very high level, which, you know, you've totally capitalized on.
But also think that, I mean, it's a couple of things that we talked about Philip, but we also talk about our other big brother, like, you know, Jonathan, right?
Ah, yes, Papa
you
Bear.
Know, you know, it's for me, a lot of things changes.
Well, for people, we should say, this is Jonathan Waxman, for listeners who may not be on a first-name basis.
Exactly. But, you know, things have changed. But then again, when you look at Jonathan, things haven't changed. He's always going to teach. He's always going to be Jonathan.
He's always going to serve you a roasted chicken.
Yeah.
83 to now.
And we always want to feel like, I want to talk to that guy. You know, whatever the part is, you always sit, the part is right where he's at.
Yeah.
And those things matters. And I just feel like I owe a lot to someone like that, that just, we think we've seen a lot. We haven't seen anything compared to him.
Amen to that.
You know?
Yeah, very true. So we want to talk about London, but before
speaking of Waxman, that's a good segue to London.
Yeah,
but before we do that, you know, Marcus, I got to be honest, until we were prepping for the show and I went on your website, I didn't realize how many restaurants you had a hand in. I mean, restaurants in Sweden and Norway and
a plethora,
a lot of restaurants. Before we talk about London, how do you must get approached, I'm sure, all over the States and all over the world with opportunity.
Yeah.
What's your decision-making template for where you want to put your, first of all, your good name, and then your resources and your limited time and you know, waking hours?
Well, they're all very different. In Scandinavia, obviously, when I grew up there, it's very important for me to have a restaurant in my hometown in Gothenburg.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a restaurant in a 1920s post office. My mom was always bugging for me, like, why do I always have to travel to get your food? And why does it have to be expensive? I'm like, all right, mom, first, A, it's good for you to get out of the house. B, you don't pay. So, like, what are you talking about? But I got the principle of that. So then we did really well. And now we have one restaurant concept throughout Scandinavia.
Yep.
In Rooster, it's never going to be about growth. It's really about, does it community the way we go to, can I feel like I have something to say with it? Can we learn from that community? Can it add to what we're doing as a family? And Roosters, the request for doing more Roosters has been constant, but I felt like we're not going to do it until we really find a neighborhood that, you know, we can really either add or learn from. And I thought when Shoreditch, I just went back and back, and I'm like, it feels like...
This is the neighborhood in London you're going to.
It feels like Bushwick for me. It felt like a little bit of Harlem, but it also felt like this area. And I'm like, as a creative person, I just love that area. I find myself coming back to East London.
What about it? I mean, you know, the cliched way to put what you're saying is it spoke to you,
yes,
right? You
yes.
feel you, there was something there that you wanted to be a part of. You're actually, Jay Rayner had a nice profile of you in The Guardian this week. Yeah. You're going to relocate there for a period of time?
Yeah, I mean, I've gone back like so many times over the last, we were slow. You know, like this was, it started 3 years ago.
Yeah. Rome wasn't built in a day. We don't think that way in New York, but.
And we're not going to open until at least another 7 months.
Right.
And it's a lot of trips back and forth, but I'm learning something every time. And, you know, I go back to St. John and all those restaurants that we know in London, but I'm learning something about the community and the food every single time. And it's a little bit different, you know? So I feel like we're open when we're open, and we're going to be an imperfect restaurant for a very, very, very long time.
Right.
But we're going to be delicious and humble, you know?
Yeah. What? How do you go about absorbing a new area like that? Do you just, is it just kind of hit the street and walk around and try rest? Like, how do you go about figuring out how you want to, I guess, calibrate the Red Rooster concept for a new place in a different country?
Well, it's a blend between a lot of cooks that I used to work with, who I know, you know, through friends of friends. So it's a lot of this. Is Armando still there? Is this guy over there? A butcher, you know, people that come from our industry, bartenders, like, you know, also because Sweden is so close, a lot of them are relocated to London. You know, it's really New York of Europe.
Yep.
So it's a lot of that, right? And then also artists, you know, my artist friends, like musicians and painters. And when they started to move to East London as well, it's a good indicator. You know, when the artists start to move to an area like this, it's kind of a good indicator. And they always said, you know, we don't go west anymore, we go east. And they go to Hackney and Shoreditch. And once you go there, you realize, oh, it's a whole different world. And that inspired me, you know.
Yeah. How do you... I'm sorry, Jimmy, did you want to get in?
No.
How do you do it, Marcus?
Yeah, you know, you're here. I could have had that one.
You had a... no, and I don't mean it in like an ass-kissing way, but like, you know, we're sitting here with you today. You look pretty rested. I know you were celebrating the kickoff of the...
Bobby got me last drunk.
Night.
Bobby Flay got me drunk last night.
This is, but you know the good thing...
None of us are as young as
you
we
know
used
the good
to be,
thing with Bobby? He texted me, Marcus, I lost my jacket with my wallet and my keys. And I'm like, hey, Bobby, they're just in Harlem. They'll be safe. Click. You know, we had such a good time.
But
you know,
how do you allocate yourself with the number of things you're doing? Where do you put your own time?
It's team. You know, it's team, you know. Like, if you're a good leader, people want to come and work for you. And if you're not a good leader, you have to have a smaller restaurant where it's you, almost like omakase style, whatever, and each chef to their own. You know, every chef is different and has a different story to tell. I really like my team. And I also want those chefs now to grow. And they inspire me all the time. Like, there's a bunch of shit every day that I don't know anything about. I don't.
Because you trust them. If it needs to get to you, they'll let you know it. If not, they're dealing with it, kind of thing?
It's deeper than that. You know, it's really, you know, we're on top of each other. We fight. We're, like, on top of each other. You know, it's not political correct or HR correct, but we're, like, we're...
What do you mean you fight? You fight about creative stuff?
They take pride. It's like, chef, I don't want to do this dish. We have to do it this way. And I want that bite back. If you don't have a pushback, it's over.
It sounds more familial than straight business practice.
Yeah. Well, that's
exactly.
Well, that's, I mean, that's what your guy's business is, right? Yeah. I mean,
it is, but they don't want us to act like that.
Who's they?
The people that give us the more regulations each month.
Yeah. No, but I mean, like, we're an industry that come up sort of blend between blue collar and white collar, and it's going in a different direction. But we have something to say, and we don't say it in a boxed in way, you know. And we push each other.
Yeah.
But that's also, I'm like, if my chefs don't push back on me, I'm like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
Right.
Like, was that an evolution for you? I mean, you came up in the European system
completely,
where you did not question anything. You might get smacked.
Yeah.
right?
You just would be let go.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, or whatever, sort of screamed at or fought. Yeah,
just
whatever.
Go home.
Yeah.
And, but was it an evolution for you? This seems to me to be something that's really happened in the last, like, 10 years, maybe 8 years, that chefs are opening up to the idea of things. You can have something be collaborative without sacrificing your authority or your
or at
leadership.
Least democratic.
Yeah, but I think a lot of things changed, right? Like, obviously, internet changed everything, the access of ingredients, the access of traveling and so on, right? And then also when the consumer became more diverse, not just from a race point of view, but also from more women, and then, you know, different, you know, the world became closer and your dining room changed, right? Because then people just didn't want to have this one-noted food anymore. They wanted to have plurethal type of food, which then you look around in your diverse kitchen, it's like, maybe I'm not the guy that knows sofrito the best. You know, it changes everything.
Right.
You know, maybe I do not know exactly. So you start leading from a secure place,
right,
but just completely different.
Well, you know, it's so funny. I had a chance to talk to Fabian and Jeremiah, the guys who have Contra and Wild Air.
Yeah.
And we were talking, and, you know, they're really young, right? They're, Jeremiah's maybe 30. Fabian's, yeah, like, a couple years younger.
Jeremiah worked for me at Rooster. He did a great job.
But,
job.
You know, we were talking about this idea. Like, there's this old line, you know, the chef's the person who knows the most in the kitchen, right? And he said something to me. It's so obvious, but it so speaks to where we are now, right? And he said, well, I don't know that that'll ever be true because, one, like you were just saying, one guy might know Thai food really well. One guy might know this really well. And, you know, the barometer used, or the measuring stick used to be French, right? The Escoffier, like, classic playbook.
Sure.
If you knew that and you could do that better than anyone, you win, right?
Yeah.
But now the influences that come into a kitchen are boundless, right? So to your point, you may have people working for you who know entire types of cuisine from which you might pull a little bit of influence, and that doesn't weaken you as the chef.
No, but we've also gone from specific origin of either regions or countries to technique-driven food.
Sure.
So you can use a Thai technique without doing a Thai dish.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like when Andy's fermenting his fish, it's really of a Thai heritage, but he might finish it with a completely different sauce. So, you know, it's not like where we're only cooking from one region of Italy. You could do that.
Sure.
Or you can use that, you know, orchetti because it's fantastic, and you maybe use it with ramps because it's the season.
Right.
And then you might fry some soft shell crab on that because it's delicious.
Right.
Now, what country does that belong to? It belongs to delicious.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. But also, I mean, this brings us back full circle. This is also very, to me, I mean, now it's sort of, you see it everywhere, but to me, you know, this is very much what New York is about and food in New York is about.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It's the melting pot approach. You know, restaurants used to be, if you were an Italian restaurant, you were Italian restaurant.
Yes.
If you were a Chinese restaurant, you were a Chinese restaurant. And people stuck to what they do. Now there's this kind of, you know, global cuisine and influenced by this or that. We always had all this different food in the kitchens. Most times it was relegated to family meal. And
right.
You'd be like, God damn, kid, that's good.
Yes.
Make me that again, or just make it for me. I mean, Jose Luis, one guy's been with me for years, makes this Chipotle crab soup. And I'm like, where the hell does that idea come from? I want you to make that for me every time I'm sick, and I want you to put that on the menu once a year in February, you know?
Yeah.
But he made it for staff meal.
Well, there are people who came up. Mario Batali made this comment to me about, you know, the 80s, that in on the West Coast, a lot of the influence that found its way onto the menu came out of, and not everyone would say the same thing, but he for sure said it, and other people have said it, came out of staff meal.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, that's exactly
that's where our freedom was, you know? Yeah. Now our freedom is a little bit like, okay, I'm going to make a place that does more things. We didn't used to do that. Yeah, I don't think there's a right or wrong. I mean, it can be a little confusing when, you know, all places try to be all things to all people. I like a little identity myself.
So, sure.
I think it came from California first. You know, I don't know it as well as you guys, but when I travel there and see it, there's sort of that type of different ethnic cuisines that cook for each other, but then the other guy that's not from that ethnicity comes in and is like,
yeah,
I really like this Korean thing. This Thai is incredible. Or this Mexican thing. For me, I have a lot of California transplanting into New York.
Yeah, they got it first. You know, you look at these beautiful vegetables and they're thinking, do I need to cook that thing in butter and cream?
Yeah.
You know, maybe I'll just grill that thing and see what it is. So, I mean, you definitely have a point there. about, you know, embracing the change and the new ideas?
Because we were very, on the East Coast, we've always been very Euro in
for
our thought
sure,
process.
100%.
Right? And we, that shift is also happening. But you know what? One thing, I want to give a shout out to a dear friend, Bill Telepan. We came up at the same time, and he's such an amazing chef and done so much for Cooking for Kids and taught so many young cooks. So I was really, really upset when the restaurant closed, but I know Bill's going to come back really,
yeah,
really
Bill
hard.
Announced that early in the week. And just so you know, Marcus, you can see the last question I had for you was Telepan.
Yeah,
we were all very sad to hear that. For people who are listening and don't know, Bill, Telepan restaurant announced its closing. We all sort of woke up to that news this
week.
But
he's gonna come back and hit
Bill,
it again.
Always does.
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah. Always
without
does.
A doubt.
But then it was one of those, like, you go, boop. You know, like, you know, it's like, what happened?
It's a, you know, sign of the times. You know, you can do great work and, you know, you can be forced or want to not do it anymore. I sent Bill, I didn't want to reach out. I you know, I just wrote him a note and said, hey, listen, you know, I've been there.
Yeah.
You know,
if you ever we all been. What you, we all been and we're all close. So, but, you know, we're chef, we stick together, and it's a little fraternity club, essentially.
Well said.
Yeah.
So, Bill, our condolences, but we know you'll be back.
Yep.
Bigger and better. With that, we'd like to thank our guest, Marcus Samuelson.
Can I come back
here today?
This was so much
Please,
fun.
Oh, my God. Anytime. It's so great.
We only got half the interview in.
Good.
We love you, Marcus.
So I have to come back.
Yeah, maybe you'll come back later on and talk to us about the CCAP.
Thank you. I definitely would love
to
come back.
We would love to hear you speak about that.
You know, this show lives on in perpetuity. If you were listening to it between May 19th and May 22nd, 2016, if you're in the New York area, get up to Harlem, Eat Up. They have a website. You can find out all the events. It's a very well-organized website. We would like to thank our sponsor, Restaurant Owner App. Delighted to have you guys aboard this season. You can follow us on at Chef Podcast on Twitter. That's at Chef Podcast. We're also on Facebook at The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew. And if you do listen to us on iTunes, where you can subscribe to us, it would make our day if you wrote a review or just gave us a rating. It helps. We'd love to thank our engineer, David Tadashore, for his piloting our ship. I got the thumbs up. Did I pronounce your name right today, David? I finally get it. I've had a mental block on David's name. I feel horrible every week.
You're so close. It's Tadashore.
Tadashore. I thought that's what I said. I have to go get diagnosed for learning disability.
It might be in how you say it this way.
All right. Marcus, again, thanks for coming in on this busy week.
Thank you, Marcus.
For The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew, I'm Andrew Friedman.
I'm Jimmy Bradley.
We'll see you back right after Memorial Day. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.